Vasanan, who conquered the yogic asanas, or sitting posture. Shanta, pacified. Samana, straight. Vigrahan, whose bodies. Pare, transcendental. Amale, free from all material contamination. Brahmani, in the supreme. Yojita, engaged. Atmanaha, whose minds. Sura asura idyaha, worshipped by the demons and by the demigods. Dadrishe, saw. Sma, in the past. Naradaha, the great sage Narada. Translation. After practicing the yogasanas for mystic yoga, the prajetas manage to control their life air, mind, words, and external vision. Thus, by the pranayama process, they were completely relieved of material attachment. By remaining perpendicular, they could concentrate their minds on the uppermost Brahman. While they were practicing this pranayama, the great sage, Narada, who was worshipped both by demons and by demigods, came to see them. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In this verse, the words pare, amale, are significant. The realization of Brahman is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam. The absolute truth is realized in three phases: impersonal effulgence, Brahman, localized Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. In his prayers, Lord Shiva concentrated upon the personal features of Parabrahman, described in personal terms as Snigdha Pravrin Ganesham. That's from the Srimad Bhagavatam 4:24-45. Following the instructions of Lord Shiva, the Prachetas also concentrated their minds on the Shyamsundar form of the Supreme Brahman. Although impersonal Brahman, Paramatma Brahman, and Brahman as the Supreme Person are on the same transcendental platform, the personal feature of the Supreme Brahman is the ultimate goal and last word in transcendence. The great sage Narada travels everywhere. He goes to the demons and the demigods and is equally respected. He is consequently described here as Surasuredya, worshipped by both the demons and by the demigods. For Narad Muni, the door of every house is open. Although there is perpetual animosity between the demons and the demigods, Narad Muni is welcome everywhere. Narad is considered one of the demigods, of course, and the word Devarshi means the saintly person among the demigods. But not even the demons envy Narad Muni. Therefore, he is equally worshipped by both the demons and by demigods. A perfect Vaishnava's position should be just like Narad Muni's, completely independent and unbiased. So I'll read the translation again. After practicing the yogasana for mystic yoga, the prachetas manage to control their life air, mind, words, and external vision. Thus, by the pranayama process, they were completely relieved of material attachment. By remaining perpendicular, they could concentrate their minds on the uppermost Brahman. While they were practicing this pranayama, the great sage Narada, who was worshipped both by demons and by demigods, came to see them. So this explains the practice and the realization of the prachetas. They were practicing Ashtanga Yoga, as mentioned here, and concentrating their minds on the Supreme. And Prabhupada, first of all, explains that this specifically means upon Krishna. Because they had already been taught by Lord Shiva about transcendence, and in his instructions, Lord Shiva explained transcendence as Ganesham, as Shamasundar, as Krishna, and as Prabhupada remarks here, that has been already been explained in the second chapter, first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the nature of the Supreme, that the Brahman is realized in three phases by the those who are knowers of the tattva, of the truth. They recognize this non-dual entity, substance, as variously as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Three different features. And although they were practicing here this mystic yoga process, actually, which is generally directed toward Paramatma, at least in the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, Paramatma is indicated as the goal of meditation and attainment. Although the yoga system is also used by impersonalists. It's a technique which can be used for a variety of purposes and ends. As we see, people are using it for all kinds of things. But here, Patanjali targets the meditation, concentration of the mind of the yogi upon the Paramatma feature. But it's actually, ultimately, Krishna explains this so clearly in Bhagavatam, in Srimad Bhagavad Gita, it's meant for Krishna. That's what he says in his description of this yoga system in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna surveys the system, discusses it, answers some doubts about it. And then it says that the highest yogi of all yogis, the one who worships me in devotional service, is the highest, Uttatama. This is Krishna's own verdict. So, the personal feature of the Supreme Brahman is the ultimate goal and last word in transcendence. So yoga involves, as you see by this process here, concentration of the mind and controlling the senses. That's the business of yoga, concentrating the mind by controlling the senses. By that process, withdrawing the attention of the senses from material engagement and fixing the mind in a one-pointed way on the Supreme. This is the yogic process. Those who are practicing in this way by the Ashtanga process, Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, so on, have one way of attaining this concentration of the mind. Pratyahara means that there is withdrawal, turning away of the senses from the objects of the senses. In other words, if you have to make the mind samadhi, goal is one-pointedness of mind, to be fixed on the Supreme without any deviation. This depth and degree of concentration is required. Then there has to be a concentration of attention and the withdrawal of the attention from other things. So that's why, this, first of all, the circumstances have to be there to leave a town, go into a forest, find a sacred place where the atmosphere is conducive, to make a proper sitting place. All these things are reviewed by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. So then this withdrawal of the senses from the objects has to happen. There can't be distractions. And after that withdrawal, then gradually there's concentration. First you withdraw the senses, and gradually you concentrate the senses on the Paramatma within the heart. Now, the Paramatma feature of transcendence is a personal feature of Krishna, four-handed Vishnu form known as Janardana or Supersoul. But that feature is not as attractive as Bhagavan. First of all, we can understand that the Paramatma feature cannot be exhaustive of what there is to the absolute truth, because the essential business of Paramatma is to be an order supplier to the living entities. But the absolute truth is more than that. And that more is disclosed when we see further that the absolute truth is Sri Krishna. And with the Paramatma feature, there's no reciprocal exchange of rasa. That's not his business. Paramatma's business, he's the intelligence that directs everything. But he doesn't engage in loving exchanges of rasa and development of affairs. That when he does that, then he's Krishna. So that's why this Bhagavan feature is further disclosure of the nature of the absolute truth. Because Paramatma by himself is limited. He's what everybody generally means by God. One who creates, maintains, and destroys the material universe. But that doesn't exhaust at all what the Supreme is capable of doing. So, in a sense, although Krishna is God, the idea of Krishna is greater than the idea of God. That's why Prabhupada begins in the Bhagavatam by explaining to everybody that the conception of the absolute truth and the conception of God are not on the same level. God simply refers to the controller of the universes. There can be conceivably many gods. But the absolute truth means the ultimate source of all energies. And when we understand the Krishna is the absolute truth, not only do we understand that he is the source of everything, but that he includes everything, but at the same time transcending all of it. Much more complete idea. And this absolute truth has been discovered to have these three features, depending on the depths of one's penetration into the Supreme. those who have gone so far, they report Brahman. Those who have gone farther report Brahman and Paramatma. And those who have gone farthest report Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. Paramatma is Krishna at work. Krishna is the supreme at play. So there's a difference. So when it comes to targeting the absolute truth as Bhagavan, their potential is there for the process of yoga. That's not there for the when the target is Paramatma or Brahman. There's a whole other world. And that's exactly, just as Narada Muni so kindly appears here, Sura Asura Igyaha. He's worshipped both by the Suras and the Asuras. This is his characteristic. So he appears here. He appears all throughout Srimad Bhagavatam. Everywhere you look, one of the major characters is Narada Muni. Much of the Bhagavatam is a narration of his various teachings. So it is actually, what we have is that it's his idea that the Srimad Bhagavatam should be disseminated to everybody, thus making the process of bhakti yoga, as we practice it, available. So it's different from this yogic process, although step by step all the same principles are maintained, but different means of going about it. In this yoga system, the Ashtanga yoga system, first of all there's withdrawal, then there's concentration. But in the bhakti yoga system, these things happen side by side. Because in the Ashtanga, Patanjali Ashtanga yoga system, there's nothing, you cannot actually concentrate your mind on transcendence until you have withdrawn your mind from the object of the senses. And therefore withdrawal of the mind from the object of the senses is a process of cold turkey. It's a process of just taking naked energy, naked self-control. And Prabhupada discusses this, and Krishna discusses this, when he describes in the sixth chapter the yoga system. In a summary of it in the beginning, he says what is entailed, how what yoga means. This is the fifth text. So he's saying, this is the general principle, he says, that yoga means one must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. For him who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. But for one who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. For one who has conquered the mind, the super soul is already reached. So on. So really what it's about is conquering the mind. That's what the yoga system is. Prabhupada says, the purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. It is stressed herein that the mind must be so trained that it can deliver the conditioned soul from the mire of nescience. In material existence, one is subjected to the influence of the mind and the senses. In fact, the pure soul is entangled in the material world because the mind is involved with the false ego, which desires to lord it over material nature. Therefore, the mind should be so trained so that it will not be attracted by the glitter of material nature, and in this way, the conditioned soul may be saved. It must be done, he says. And he quotes from the Amrita Bindu Upanishad that for a person, a human being, that mind is the cause of bondage and mind is the cause of liberation. That the mind absorbed in sense objects is the cause of bondage and mind detached from sense objects is the cause of liberation. So the focus, the battleground of yoga is mind. So we know in Vedic psychology, the subtle body of the living entity is given these three functions: mind, intelligence, and false ego. And so when it's talking about mind here, it means specifically mind. And what is that? It says, we see that we go through and survey what is understood by mind, is that it's the mind is reactive, and it is the area of what now is called the classical condition, straight Pavlovian conditioning. This is the way the mind associates with sense objects. The mind is the area where this elemental attraction and repulsion to sense objects on the basis of pleasure and pain takes place. If it feels good, the mind goes for it. And if it feels bad, the mind rejects it. This is a function of the mind. There's a higher function, intelligence, which can override this. But this is what the mind does. So you can see this, for example, if you have to take some medicine as prescribed by the doctor, especially in India, they're fond of prescribing things that are horrible tasting. In a concession to the mind in the West, they now make them confections. But in India, they like a bit more bad tasting or more potent, at least, apparently. So the doctor may prescribe some medicine. You have to take a couple of teaspoons or full. And it's bitter, it's nasty stuff. And you put it on your tongue, you put it in your mouth, and you'll see that your immediate reaction is to go, instant reflex, spit it out. That's the mind. But then, because you have intelligence, you override this, because you've received instructions from this authority of the physician that this is good for me in the long run. And in spite of this refusal of the mind to accept this, you take it. Anyway. When children who have, as a rule, little intelligence, they'll spit it out no matter what. And the parent has to act like the intelligence and more or less force them to take the medicine. And the parent will say, well, it's good for you, it'll make you well, it'll make your ears stop hurting or whatever, but the child, being mental, just that spits it out. Right? And similarly, if something tastes good, the mind just, of whatever it is, whatever sins, just do it. So what's happened, as we've been admired in sense gratification, the mind has built up all these associations of attraction and repulsion to sense objects on the basis of sense gratification. The mind is the arena of habit. That's where all these habits take place. So when we come to Krishna consciousness, because the mind has all these habits, it's the enemy. And it's strong, it's tenacious, it's got incredible inertia. Everybody knows who's tried to change a bad habit, how hard it is. You're fighting the mind. Just one thing, if you've been smoking cigarettes or other things, you've had some bad habit and you try to change it, it is difficult, hard work. But you do that because there's the higher facility of intelligence. So mind is sort of like a computer, and intelligence becomes the programmer of the computer to make it do something. But you just can't give it instructions once. You have to keep doing it and doing it and doing it until finally you've managed to erase one neural pattern and replace it with another neural pattern, so to speak. I don't know what really goes on in a physiological way, but I suspect it's something like that. You're really down there working with cells and things like that and making chemical changes take place, which is why it's hard. You've got stubborn, resistant matter being moved around. So this is how yoga proceeds. Therefore, when the mind is unconquered, that is to say, when it's the repository of so many habits of sense gratification, it's very, very, it's your enemy. But when the mind has been reprogrammed, has been conquered with a fresh set of habits, then that same inertial, stubborn, resistant habits, nature of the mind, will carry you through. And you don't have to make decisions anymore about certain things. And then we're in the ISKCON jargon, a person who has trained his mind is then said to be off the mental platform, because these things have been established by intelligence. I've used this example before in this connection, that most of us do not decide every day whether or not we're going to brush our teeth. And that happened long before we became devotees. And it was the work of our mothers, usually it's the mother in this connection, who has taught us that you get up in the morning and you brush your teeth. And we do that now, we just do it. You know, well, shall I brush my teeth? Well, maybe not. I mean, I did it yesterday, so I can go another day. You know, people don't think like that. You just do it. It's automatic. It's a reflex. It's in the mind. So as brushing your teeth in the morning is also, cleaning the teeth is one part of the process of bhakti yoga, that much our mind is our friend. But then there are other habits which we have, which are bad habits. Sleeping late in bed and taking bed tea, as Prabhupada calls it. Things like that. Those are bad habits. So what we do when we engage in the process of bhakti yoga is we begin. We take as a rule, I must rise early in the morning. And then there's a fight, because the mind is resistant to take up this habit. Rising early in the morning, going in, taking a shower, preferably cold, does not appeal to the mind that has been immersed in sense gratification as the way to go. It doesn't feel so good at that time. You're often sleepy or so on, think. So it has to be conquered. But when the conquering process has taken place, and it becomes a habit that one rises early in the morning, then you do it the same way you brush your teeth. You don't even think about it. It's just something that happens. Then one's well established. At that point, the mind, having been successfully retrained in this way, or reprogrammed, at that point, it becomes your best friend. It'll carry you right on through. That's what this is talking about. Now, Arjuna says later on to Krishna said these two things, and he described this process. And that was Arjuna. You can see that he's just waiting for Krishna to finish up so he can, like, say his piece. Wait a minute. This won't work. Yeah. And he says it's impractical and unendurable because what? The mind is restless and unsteady. And he says, what other words? Restless, turbulent, obstinate, very strong. To subdue it is like controlling the wind. That's his objection. First thing, right off the bat. And Krishna says, yes, that's true. But by suitable practice and detachment, it can be done. He says, if your mind is unbridled, you'll never make it unbridled. But if it's controlled and you strive by what Krishna says is appropriate means, you'll gain success. And Prabhupada comments in his purports to these two verses that the appropriate means at this point is not this Ashtanga Yoga system. We have a more appropriate means, which is the Bhakti Yoga system, which achieves the same thing. Which doesn't try to shut down the senses as the Ashtanga Yoga system does, but rather gives us the senses a higher engagement immediately in the Supreme. The Bhakti Yoga system, by the grace of Krishna, brings Bhagavan literally within reach. In the Arch Avatar, in the deity form, he comes right within reach. He appears as this way, Saguna Brahman. Brahman manifested through material qualities. And so that even though we're on the most primitive level, Krishna appears. And it's Krishna. It's not a substitute for Krishna. It's not a symbol for Krishna. The deity is Krishna. And so he appears in this way instantly. So even though we are the most neophyte of neophytes, we can immediately attain direct perception of the Supreme and engage in the service of the Supreme. And this is the system, by utilizing the senses. That the Bhakti Yoga system gives the senses engagement in the Supreme immediately, and the mind through hearing, chanting, and so on. So the obstacle that is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, that you may withdraw your senses from sense objects, but that taste for them remains. See, there's the mind. The mind has a tab, not just the habit of the senses coming into the sense object, but the taste remains. It's a kind of impure reminiscence or false association. That we have associated sense objects with sense gratification. This is actually a false association. Sense objects are not seen as they are. We have associated them with our sense gratification. So that when one perceives the automatic habit of having associated sense objects with sense gratification, is that if one sees an attractive member of the opposite sex, one immediately thinks of this person as a prospective sexual partner because that association has been there. And similarly, when one sees things to eat, things to touch, things to smell, that is all the basis of my sense gratification. This is the false. This false association is anartha. It's unwanted. It's the contamination of the mind. Now, just to break off our traffic with these sense objects, that's all right. But how are you going to keep that false association in the mind already? Assume the objects are all clothed in the subjective aura of our sense gratification. We don't see them as they are. we see them as a false way, in a false way. That these things are enjoyable by me. So it's only the process of bhakti yoga that simultaneously engages our senses in the service of Krishna and also allows us to engage the sense objects in the service of Krishna. And by doing that, then that false mental habits are gradually destroyed. And there's a taste that develops. There's an appreciation. First of all, you have something to do. I may try to sit like a Zen student and just focus on nothing. But that's very hard, and people who do that say it's like a descent into insanity because the mind goes crazy. Because they're trying to... The idea is you should have no mind whatsoever. And we agree, you should have no material mind. But if our mind is absorbed in thought of Krishna, if our mind is absorbed in reading Srimad Bhagavatam, talking about Srimad Bhagavatam, executing Krishna's service, hearing the holy name, reflecting on the holy name, then that same is achieved automatically. The silence is there. Prabhupada said, chanting Hare Krishna is silence. You want to know what that elusive sound is that all those Zen people keep listening for? Beyond even one hand clapping? It's the Hare Krishna mantra. It's silence. There's no material sound. So because the absolute truth has positive spiritual content, and through the process of bhakti yoga, we are brought into commerce with that positive spiritual content, then our commerce with matter for sense gratification automatically comes to an end. We feel immediately we're connected to the highest. And because we're immediately connected to the highest, Krishna consciousness becomes the easiest yoga system. This is Prabhupada's famous, it is easy and sublime. Sublime because we are targeted not just on Brahman, not just on Paramatman, but Bhagavan, and easy. Because of the facility given to us by Narada Muni and others, we can actually immerse ourselves, all our senses and all our mind entirely into Krishna. And that immersion is required. And when that immersion is there, then automatically the engagement of the mind and the senses with the material sense object stops. You don't have loose receptors hanging around just waiting for something to lock in. Everything's engaged in Krishna. So all the you know, like they say that cells have like receptors on their surfaces, and viruses come and they hook on to these receptors and they do different things. That's how they get in. And one way to stop the viruses from invading is taking something benign that fills up all the same receptors so the viruses have no access. How's that for an up-to-date analogy? That's how Krishna consciousness works. So in this way, by this targeting in this manner on the Brahman, on the Param Brahma, on the personal feature of Brahman, Shyama Sundar form, then all these yoga purposes are fulfilled in this way. So we have to commit ourselves to it, that's all. It's a practice, and the process of retraining, of re-educating, reprogramming, whatever you want to call it, the mind has to be undertaken diligently, conscientiously, and with determination. So at first, one feels a struggle. Naturally, there has to be a struggle. If there's not a struggle, we're not doing our job. Because the mind has to be conquered. That's a word. It's a military word. But it has to be. Otherwise, we're going to be in danger at all times. So we have to become, through the intelligence, which receives the directions from Krishna, through the intelligence, we have to become the controller of our mind. Then we'll not be swept away by so many desires. But the mind is intractable and is very, very difficult. And sometimes, due to long or fortunate experience, we have very nasty minds. Lots of bad habits. Full of two things, desire and hate. And gradually, by this process, that desire and hate that are within the mind, it all has to become emptied out. But it's there, these habits. It's amazing how tenacious they are, how they can sneak up on us if we're not vigilant and determined and don't take advantage of the purifying practices. For the Sankirtan movement, the Cheto Dharpana Marjana, this is what it does. It cleans it like a solvent. Gets in there, all the little nooks and crannies, and bubbles out all the dirt. It's hidden in different places. Gradually cleans it out like a solvent. It's given by Krishna. And we simply have to apply it to take advantage of it. So, any comments or questions? That if you're serious in your practice, you're guaranteed to succeed, because whatever our own incapacities are, the mercy comes in two ways. First of all, just by making the holy name available, just by making the practice available, just by giving us the directions how to do it, because it's hard. You can't do it without somebody saying, well, you need help here, you need help here. You want to go to look, I have this problem, and there's somebody there to help you. So first of all, just to be given the facility to do this practice. And many of us, somehow really get into contact and come to this practice without being qualified. Just like you get into university sometimes, you have to have certain qualifications, not the least of which is financial. And yet, if you don't have them, somebody, they give you the money. That's mercy. You didn't do anything to deserve it, but they give you the money. So we're not qualified for the system of bhakti yoga. Without a doubt, no one's qualified. Our big qualification is that we're qualified for hell. And most of us, to some degree, have lived there, thinking in a nice place. But we're not qualified. So first of all, we have access. That's the first thing. And the thing is that now that we've got here, also, if we have problems, there's all the help that we need. If we just ask. So that's the element of mercy that's there. Because in the bhakti yoga system, we get the grace of Krishna. We don't sit down. I mean, you really want to do a lot of hard work. Try pranayama, pratyahara,
And you have to become a mental and physical athlete of monumental proportions. But if you can just chant the holy name and call out for Krishna, all those things happen, even though you're not so expert. If you want to practice Jnana Yoga, someone will say, you are practicing Jnana Yoga. Well, first of all, you have to show your mastery of Sanskrit. Really, you have to become expert at Panini grammar if you really want to do it. Otherwise, you're an amateur and you won't succeed. But anybody can take up this process. And the success comes because Krishna says, for that person, he says, I become the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. Other people may have difficulty. But the one who surrenders to me and becomes my devotee says, I'm the swift deliverer. The Gyani, for example, because he has a long process. But for the devotee, I quickly come.